This is a talk I've written this afternoon, actually. And I want to do that for a while because I'm getting very excited about all the HTML5 stuff, and everybody is. But I think it's time we ask a few questions, and I need you to do that for me, because only the people that are already in that world are the people that don't ask these questions anymore, because they're like, hey, man, it's all good, don't worry, it's going to sort itself out. And my job, and when I left Yahoo, I said my job is to make HTML5 work and make Mozilla to be the Switzerland of HTML5 in between the battlefield that is Google, Apple, Microsoft, Adobe, and other people who claim to do that right now. So I just want this to work. I've been a web developer for 12 years. I've worked for every crap browser out there. I worked with a lot of really bad content management systems. And I don't want us to spend money and use proprietary technology just to put a video on our pages, because the time of the web just being text and links is over. It makes so much more sense to have a properly immersive media that is wonderful for everybody, and you shouldn't have to buy software to do that. Browsers should be free and also work across different platforms. And yeah, thanks to Google, that whole thing has been a lot more questions lately than it had before. So it would be a change from my normal talks. Instead of giving you the facts, I give you some facts, but I ask some questions that I don't give you the answer to. It's quite amazing when you did several speeches and wrote some books, people come up to you and always ask for the 5-second answer. Like, what do you think of that? And you're like, well, there's so many things in that I really don't like. Okay. It's like, yeah, Firefox sucks. This is what the answer that they expect, you know? Everybody wants to see you battle it out, and it just doesn't make any sense to me anymore. So let me tell you a story. Stories are really important, because stories make us understand what happened before and actually learn from our mistakes. Back in 1939, there was a problem then at Antarctica. Wasn't explored yet. It was just this white thing, and nobody knew what's going on there. And it's a very hostile environment. Humans are not that happy down there. It's quite funny that we live on this planet where half the year we have to put other animals on us not to die, and the other half we just get red if we go into the sun. And this is one of those places where people just shouldn't be. So the idea was we want to explore Antarctica, and we want to have a vehicle that actually allows a team of 5 people for 3 months to survive down there and actually drive the whole thing and find out and do all kind of measurements and see what's going on. Problem with Antarctica is there's 2 things. First of all, it's friggin' cold. Duh. And secondly, there's these massive cracks in the ice fields that could only be like 5 meters wide, but 60 miles long. So if you have like a 3-month track, you don't want to go 60 miles across these different cracks. So these were the specs of the whole task. So we want something where people can sit in there for 3 months, not die, not go like cabin crazy, and there's cracks in the ice we have to go over, and it's really cold down there, so we have to do something about it. And that is why somebody came up with the Arctic Explorer. This is a cut of the whole thing. This is what it looked like. So you had like food storage, you had a plane in case everything goes wrong, you had double-deck bunks where people sleep with this beautiful lady in there. I've seen that. You had fuel tanks under the bunks, which is quite scary. You had diesel engines, charter control room, control panel, machine shop, and you had these massive retractable wheels. Retractable wheels, and you had spare tires as well, in case you actually have a flat tire. You see here that these wheels can be retracted into the car. And the idea was that because it's so friggin' cold, tires actually get brittle overnight if they don't move. So the idea was to retract the tires, put them in the car, and then the heating of the engine would actually heat up them overnight as well, so there's no problem, they don't get brittle, they just stay smooth and cool, and everything is fine. So that was really thought through and really nicely done in these massive tires. This is what the thing looked like when they tried it out in Michigan, I think, where they built it. And then they showed how you would go through one of these cracks by having this little creek that they tried it out on. So you can actually detract the one tire in there and use the other one for propelling and push the whole thing over, and once you're over, you do it the other way around and pull the car out that way. So it was really, they thought about this crack problem quite nice. They could say it cracked it. This is what the thing looked like. It was huge, and basically this was this media hype about it. People loved it. It was just like, this thing is the best, coolest thing ever. So it actually was two weeks delayed already by coming to the harbor, because so many people in every city that they came around and took pictures of it and wanted to know things about it and got very excited about it. And that was all in 1939. And this is a video now how the when it landed in Antarctica from the ship, and how they actually wanted to get it on the ice. Yes, it's a colored video, but somebody colored it. So before people say 1939, you're lying to us. It can't be that. But it actually is somebody went through the video and colored it up. So this is what the thing looked like. And you see in comparison, that's a person, that's the tire. And this is the ramp that they built on from the ship to go down on the ice floe to start exploring Antarctica. And it went down there, and we have a massive fail because the thing crashes in, and he has to basically rev up the engine and try to save it. You see all the smoke coming out. So they almost lost the whole thing while they were getting it off the ship. And then you see it's already smoking, and the whole landing thing was not there. So the delivery mechanism of your new technology onto the environment where you're supposed to apply it was already not strong enough. It's a bit like a 56K connection on like a high resolution video. And the fun thing then was, they put it up there and put it on the ice float, and the wheels spun uselessly because they never tested it on ice. They tested it on the road while they were going down there and said like, okay, the mathematics, the physics work out, this thing is going to be the best explorer ever. And it just spun uselessly, so they tried to put some chains on it, and they used the spare tires to double the space that the tires have, which would already mean that they won't be retractable anymore. And if there's something wrong with the tire, there wouldn't be any spare tire anymore. So it was a colossal, absolute, massive failure, that thing. And they left it alone because the Second World War started and they had to put scientists onto other more interesting projects, and came back 5 years later and tried something with it again. It didn't work out. The fate of that thing was that it cracked off an ice float and went somewhere into the ocean. Nobody knows what happened to that thing. And it was the massive, massive, successful, great technology here. So let's analyze what went wrong then. It was purely engineering driven. No person ever, except the people that were supposed to drive that thing for 5 months, were put on the last week. So people just said, like, okay, here's a physical problem, here's a technical solution, let's build the thing. It was tested while it was on the road, because it took them too long to get the funding for it, so the weather conditions would have been even worse in Antarctica if it took them longer. So while they were driving it through the US, they put new features in, and they tried out new things, much like we do after it's been hacked for the first time, or people on Twitter have found it. And it was never tested in a real environment. They didn't go on ice with it, which completely baffles me. You're like, well, this thing is supposed to drive around for 3 months in the ice conditions. Maybe putting it on ice would be a good idea. And there was a massive media excitement even before it proved its worth. It was like the headlines for like weeks and weeks and weeks. And if you look at all these features here that we have in this thing, that's exactly what we're doing right now with HTML5. I don't see many designers talking about HTML5. They talk about CSS3. I don't see many people coming from UX perspectives looking at the date pickers in HTML5 and these kind of things. We just hope that some engineer in Google, Microsoft, or Mozilla will do the right thing and give us to that, and we bitch about it when it's wrong. And that's what we're doing right now with HTML5. So HTML5 is the new hotness. So we have this old technology, and we upgrade to better technology, and we all get really excited about it. That's why when you look up for HTML5, you find like all these demo rooms where like, look, you can put a video on a cube and rotate it in real time, which every client so far asked me to do. You have puzzle games, you have video, all these kind of things. So you have all these wonderful showcases of what can be done. This is Apple's showcase that only worked in Safari, which is, no, it's not HTML. And it's like basically video behind in SVG mask and typography as HTML5. What? No, it's not. We mix all the new technologies and put them together and say it's HTML5 and ooh, new stuff. Much like DHTML used to be before, much like Web 2.0 used to be before, then Web 3.0 used to be before. Marketing people just want to have a new feature. Yesterday, Google had this the Google I/O sign-up page had this countdown that was dropping balls all over the place. That was nothing in HTML5 in the whole thing. And it was like, did you like our HTML5 countdown? Today they made the great logo with the Jules Verne thing. That was HTML5, but the marketing department didn't put it on the blog. They just made people find it, and I had to explain to people on Twitter what it was. There was even an advent calendar of HTML5 demos. So when you look for HTML5, you find all this stuff. And in a lot of cases, it's not about HTML5. It's about typography. It's about animation. It's about putting some videos together and saying, like, that's the future of the web. So everything is HTML5, including browser-specific tricks. So a lot of stuff will only work in Chrome, will only work in Safari, or only work in Firefox, and still people say it's because of the standard. It's not part of the standard in most of the cases. You do tricks that the browser gives you. And we've done that with colored scroll bars in Internet Explorer in 1999. And that's why we have so many bad applications out there, because we trusted one browser rather than trusting the standard. So to a degree, it's understandable, because there's a lot of confusion about the players and the specs. Is it the WG group? Is this the W3? Is Safari other people? Do Chrome make HTML5? Who makes HTML5? And it's also HTML as a standard was just markup and a bit of form elements. HTML5 looks differently. So HTML5, and I put the 5 already in parentheses, is because the what group says, like, there's no 5, it's just HTML, it's a living standard. Just deal with it, and it's going to be different all the time. It's partly it's markup. So that's just a little bit of it. These are the new elements that we have, like header, footer, section, these kind of things. Then there is a big part of JavaScript APIs, like the player APIs I showed earlier, what allows you to play video, some other APIs for storage and these kind of things. And they get taken out of HTML5 and put into their own standard when they become too big as well to make things even worse. And then you have stuff for browser and parser developers. And this is why HTML5 is actually cool. Because for the first time, the specification tells you what a browser should do with the stuff it gets. Not like, oh, in Pixie Magic, this is how it should look. So every browser implementer in the past just built things that hopefully do the right examples and do the right rendering. That's why we have all these differences in box models, and that's why the rendering speed is different from browser to browser and the way they build up pages. And HTML5, this is part of the spec. And then there's, of course, a big part of general what the fuck, like in every spec. But this is the main difference. So when HTML5 purists talk to you and say, like, hey, it should only be HTML, then they say, have you read the spec? Have you looked at the spec? 80% of it is not for people that build websites. 80% is for people that build browsers and parsers. And that is a good thing. It gives people, though, lots of space for interpretation, because some people like the markup, other people like the JavaScript APIs, and other people just like what the browser stuff says. And it also allows them to focus only on that and say everything else not necessary. So when I see an HTML5 application, to me it's already a mix of HTML and JavaScript, because I have APIs in the specification and not just an HTML page. And of course the opportunity to run, to say, like, well, this is HTML5, not CSS3, and I can do it better in Flash, I can do it better in Silverlight, I can do it better in Java, not really. But I can get my technology and be there and bitch to other people, and that's why I'm a great developer. So the main premise of HTML5 is pragmatism, making things simpler for all of us. Because it was not fun until now, and it still probably isn't, to build web applications. 80% of our job was to know how different browsers fail. The syntax of HTML, JavaScript, and CSS was never magic, but what the browsers did with it was just completely random. And the more you knew, the better you built these things. So you actually had to fix and patch all the time. And I'm sick of that. I don't want to do that. I want to build applications for end users, not for a browser. And another big topic was that XML is just not for the web. XML was such an archaic and academic approach to content that on the web we just didn't want to have. It was just too complex, everything. It was too rigid. End users should not suffer for the errors of authors. This is what a lot of HTML5 people said. If an XML document shows you an error and says, like, sucks to be you, I can't show that, our end users can't fix any of that, so they feel inadequate. I'm not sure if that's true, because I liked when a browser, for example, Netscape 4, you didn't close your table, it didn't render the table, because it was not a table, it could have been anything. But in HTML5, we went and said, like, you know, you can't give rigid documents to the web, and somebody has to fix that. So this is what an HTML4 or 1 strict document looked like, and this was my template in my browser whenever I just put it in my editor whenever I started it. Yet this wonderful doctype HTML with this this explanation here points to some DTD that no browser ever enforced. So it tells you what the HTML should be like, but didn't matter really. You can put like Disney.com there, it doesn't matter. You define the language, you have to define the content type, which is HTTP equiv, and the content is text HTML with a charset of UTF-8. And then you had a title, a link for style sheet, script node, and a H1 for heading, P and P class footer for the footer at the end of the document, or div class footer, or whatever you want to do. And you will find a lot of HTML5 guys right now going out and saying like, starting with like, HTML5 is so awesome because I don't have to type that in, because I never could remember what the thing was. And I'm sorry, if you type that in by hand, you're doing it wrong. Since 1997, I had an editor that I could say doc type and it would generate the doc type for me. I don't have to type that in by hand. I don't type every tag in by hand. This is what we've done when we used, I don't know, like command.com and dos.bat. It's like not necessary anymore because we have systems that help us with that. But the point is right. If this stuff is not used by anything, why do we put it in there? Why do we really put this extra in there? And there's a big thing, and I will give a talk, I think, about this, about less code is better than anything else. And I totally not agree, because if your less code is not readable or not understandable by somebody else, and you're the only person that can actually maintain it, then you haven't done anything good for the web or the market or your company. But you made yourself indispensable, which means you can't grow yourself into a different world or into a different role later on. So HTML5 got rid of all the stuff that are not necessary. So the whole doctype HTML is all you have. HTML language equals EN. The whole like HTTP equivalent stuff went down to meta charset equals UTF-8. And then you had a title in there, your link rel, and your heading, paragraph, and footer. So this is where the document type in HTML allows you now to put the same document in. And across all the supporting browsers, this works. It's wonderful. It does the job. HTML5 also includes new semantic elements based on the class names that were in use. So what they've done, they looked at what class names people use on the web and then came up with semantic elements that according to that. So there's like heading, footer, section, article. It didn't use the class name MSO norm, which is generated by every content management system in Microsoft. But what it assumed was basically that people do it right on the web, and the more people do it, the righter it gets, which every election shows you is not necessarily true. Instead of having this like H1, that is one header per page, and instead of having just paragraphs to structure our document, we basically have a header element, we have a section element, and we have a footer element, which allows you to do all this stuff. So HTML5 defines and expects browsers to fix omissions for us, and doesn't mind case or quotes. So you can write any HTML that you want to, and in XHTML4 and XHTML1 or HTML401 strict, you weren't allowed to actually use uppercase or lowercase or omit the quotes around attributes. You can now in HTML5. Then you have, of course, elements that allow different values of an attribute, like class, for example. You can apply different classes. As soon as you have two classes in there, you have to put quotes around it again. Logic, non-logic, I'm not sure about this. So you have your doctype HTML. And then I made an uppercase title here, an uppercase link, and uppercase header, and didn't put a head in there, and footer is like uppercase, lowercase, closed. Which is, yeah, valid HTML5. You can write this kind of stuff. You can really, and you already see that the color coding that I've had in the other one is completely short. So our editors now don't know if that's HTML already or if it's something else. So the reason is that browsers do that anyways. Browsers are already fixing stuff for you. As a browser developer, your main job was to make sure that the crap that the people put on the web renders out as something useful. And people never gave HTML much love. They just put things there and said, like, well, if I put 12 font elements around it and 12 big elements, it's bigger, right? Awesome. Done. Job done. And you look at stuff that content management systems create, you're like, Jesus, this is just bad. This is when you put that same page inside Firefox and then do view-generated code, which actually does the header and it closes the header for you, it injects a head for us, and it actually makes the section in there and closes all the things and lowercases all of them and makes it into readable HTML again. So the browser fixes all these things for us. But what happens if, for example, here I just get rid of that P element and I have it inside another section element with uppercase and lowercase. So let's get rid of that P and then see what the browser does with it. And what the browser now does with it, it moves the footer from the bottom into that section and closes the P after that for some reason. So by not closing an element, the browser had to make an educated guess what's going on there, and it moved the footer where it's not supposed to be. And you never want to have the foot where it's not supposed to be. So we're trusting technology to fix things that humans have done wrong, which is not necessarily a good course of action. Browsers fix a lot of stuff for us. This has always been the case. We've become lax. We've become bored. We've become like, okay, I can put anything out there, it's fine. My question that I'm not going to give you the answer to, but I'm just wondering about, is like, can you do innovation based on people did this all the time anyways? People wrote invalid HTML. People thought things don't need a doc type. People thought things the browser do it right for us. Can I say, I want to do a new thing. Let's base it on how people did it wrong in the past. Or let's fix everything for them and condescendingly say the browser will fix things for people because they never will understand how to write HTML anyways. The other question is it HTML or BML? Is it hypertext markup language or browser markup language? Should I expect a browser to make this a valid document? With XML, yes, it was too complex, but at least it was a valid document that I could parse with any other language. There were libraries to convert it to other things. I could create from an XHTML document, I could create a PDF with an XSLT. It wasn't fun, but I could do it. But nowadays, with that stuff that we write, we expect a browser to do it, or a parser that is based on the same specification as the HTML5 standard, which now means everybody has to rewrite their parsers. Can we do that? I don't know. Should HTML be there only for browsers? What about conversion services, search bots, content scrapers? Right now, and I had this question on Twitter a few days ago, and I still don't have the answer, in HTML5, I can put sections in there with H1 elements. I can, which I should. I should tell everything this is a section, and a section is, according to the standard, reusable across different documents as a widget, for example. Now, if I put something in Google that has 200 H1s, it probably will be blocked as a spamming site. It could be a valid HTML5 document, though. You do the right thing, but is the search bot ready for it yet? And most of the things what I've seen with tests so far is that the search bot technology that we have on the web doesn't understand HTML5 yet. And we do. Can we say that the web is only browsers, or can we say that the people that do a lot of stuff that we find content on the web should also use the same technology? Let's talk about the turd in the punch bowl of our party, which is Internet Explorer and other legacy browsers. Which is, I think legacy browsers by now is just a euphemism for Internet Explorer 6, because most of the others are not there anymore. Internet Explorer 6 will not die, and there's technical reasons, there's political reasons, there's just reasons that people don't upgrade their hardware or their IT systems inside a company. And if I were a company that in 1999 spent £300,000 on building an internal system that only works on IE6, I would not necessarily say, now, you know what, delete that thing and do something new. It's not going to happen that way. And the problem is that Internet Explorer doesn't allow styling for elements it doesn't understand as part of HTML, which is all the HTML5 elements, because Internet Explorer 6 back then, HTML5 will never come. They never thought of that. So HTML is the thing we base everything on. So if we exclusively now write HTML5 elements, we give Internet Explorer 6 unstyled documents, which don't necessarily look right because everything is an inline element, and it does just make interfaces that don't work for end users. We find these problems, let's put some fixes in there. Let's make Internet Explorer 6 not suck. The first fix, elements created with JavaScript can be styled in IE. That's one of those fun things about the Internet Explorer engine. So instead of just using a header and not being able to get the style applied to it, you just put a script in your page, call document create element header, and then this CSS will be applied to the header element. You can call this Jessica, you can call it Steven, whatever you want to call that element. As soon as you create it with JavaScript, you can style it with CSS in Internet Explorer 6. Before that, you can't. So that was the first fix that basically was found by some French guy, and then it got made successful by John Resig And then Remy Sharp from Brighton came up with a great piece of software that you can just put into your document, a JavaScript file that generates all these elements for you so they become stylable. So you put this in the top of a document in Internet Explorer, and out of a sudden all the HTML elements can be stylable, which is cool. No worries, we have the technology, we can fix this. Of course, then purists of the web come around and say, like, well, HTML should work without JavaScript. You should not have to run a JavaScript. What if an Internet Explorer user goes to my page where I put this HTML5 shift library in and has JavaScript disabled? He still gets an element that's not usable. And to a degree, that's right. A content scraper like Google and Bing and Yahoo don't run JavaScript on that page. So why should that be different just to style it for Internet Explorer? So the next solution was sending HTML5 as XML or giving it a namespace inside an XML document. This is more like what I say, the batshit crazy end of the whole solution thing, because it goes back to like bringing XML as to Internet Explorer, and XHTML was never sent as XML because of that red screen of death problem, but it solves the problem again as well. So for Internet Explorer, I could send HTML5 as XML. The purest solution, which is the people that say, wait, JavaScript, HTML shift, bad idea, add divs around the new elements and actually repeat them. So for every header, for every footer, aside, a section, I have a class header, class footer, class aside, class section, and then apply my CSS. And in the HTML, this means that I have a div class section and a section, a div class footer and a footer, so I have to repeat everything, but it works in Internet Explorer and it works in the new HTML5 browsers as well. To which, when you do this, and I did this last week and I talked to people about it, they're like, so why do we do this header and section stuff then? And the answer should be like, because in the future, browsers will do something with the header and section stuff that is useful, which they should, but sadly enough, they don't yet. So the whole idea of header, section, aside, and an article is that the browser would create a content outline for me, much like a document in Word does. If I use the real headings in Word rather than just painting it, I can generate a table of contents automatically. So browsers are supposed to do that as well. None of the browsers do anything with that yet, so we put a lot of stuff in there that is not used yet because we want to be pragmatic and support them. So there's a big fallacy there. But I can see that, for example, assistive technology like screen readers and like systems for like zooming and these kind of things, the more structure you put into a document, the easier it will actually be to convert it to something else. So these elements do make sense. Bloody Internet Explorer, we always have things to do extra for it. That's why our life was in the last 10 years. The problem is, though, that all browsers fail in one way or another and need patches. Like, the HTML5 spec is applied to every browser, but it fails there, it fails here, so still we are the same spot where we have to learn about what every browser does. There's help, though. There's a script called Modernizer, which is pretty much amazing. What it does, it actually, you put it in your page, and it analyzes what the browser can do, it patches a few things that are done wrong by browsers, and it puts class names on the HTML element when something is supported. So I have, for example, here I've got HTML5 audio and HTML5 video, and there would be a class on the HTML saying audio. So in your JavaScript, you can see if HTML class name contains audio, hey, I can apply all this audio stuff. In your CSS, you can say if CSS transitions are actually available, HTML, CSS, do the rest of the transition stuff after that. Because a modernizer puts this class name in, so you know it happened. It tried it out and it applied it, and it's an amazing piece of software done by Paul Irish and a few other people, Farouk Atish as well. And it just basically tests for everything and puts everything in there. There's also the HTML5 boilerplate, which is basically download that, put it in there, and HTML5 works, which has Modernizer as part of it, and it actually has all kind of fixes for Internet Explorer and other browsers in there that makes that new stuff work. And it's by magic. The much shorter and pragmatic markup became more complex again because we have to fix all for all these old browsers. And that is a classic thing of software. Every time you say, this thing is really, really small, and then you will get feedback, and 4 weeks later you will realize it's not small anymore. The longer you play with it, the bigger it gets. Anyways, like MooTools, for example, was advertised as like only 4K. for like half a year, and then it became 16, 27, 40, 80, and it became as big as the other libraries because there were too many things to fix and too many things to put in there. When you download boilerplate, first of all, and I think that's very, very important that they do that and they do it right, it creates all this stuff, has all this stuff in there. It has an Apple Touch icon, a FAF icon for it. It has a cross-domain.xml because some of the new file features in HTML5 are only available for Internet Explorer 6 if you go through a Flash little Flash movie, and that needs a cross-domain.xml file also for cross-domain AJAX requests. You have a lot of JavaScript in there, and you have a robots.txt and a web config and NGINX config for the different, and htaccess, which is not listed on my Mac, for all the different servers. Because if your server doesn't send video with the right header, for example, the HTML5 video element will not be able to play it because it doesn't recognize that it really is a video. Whatever we do on the web is not just HTML. It's a browser setting. It's something the browser server setting. We have so many technologies to play with, so when people say, like, I write these five lines of HTML and I've done everything, they've never built a website, I'm sorry. Because if your web configuration of your server is shot, no matter what you write will not show up correctly. And if you look at the code, what they do is a lot of testing for different browsers in Internet Explorer and putting classes on it according to, like, okay, there's Node.js available here and it's IE8. There's Node.js and it's IE6 and so on and so forth. And then you do all kind of XUA compatible to send Internet Explorer 9 into the right format. Then you have a viewport settings for different browser for different mobile phones and different iOS devices. You have your links to your FAF icon and your touch icon. You have your style sheet. You have your JavaScript where you include Modernizer and the style for Modernizer. And then at the end you have you include jQuery because we use jQuery. And then you have all kind of plugins and scripts that fix things for Internet Explorer and fix things like PNG opacity and all these things as well. So putting this in, you can put now HTML5 content on the web and it will work across all the browsers. And it's great. It's basically, there's so much research going into that. And I wouldn't have the patience to do that because I just want the thing to die. But if you really, really want to use the new stuff and you have an environment where this is really important, this is what you can do. You can download it. The other solution to use HTML5, or that goes with that as part of boilerplate, is polyfills. What polyfills are is it's JavaScript files that actually fix functionality. So say, for example, I want to use WebGL, or I want to use, let's go even further, I want to do long polling in the browser using WebSockets. And the browser has WebSockets turned off, or doesn't support WebSockets. The polyfill would be to use a Flash fallback or a Java fallback if everything fails, and then actually give you the same functionality. So what a polyfill does is it overrides the functions that are not available for you with functionality that is available to that browser. So your JavaScripts will be writing according to the API in HTML5, and the browser will get the things that work for them, and you don't have to change your code. You write according to the spec, and the rest will be done by these polyfills for you. There's not a polyfill available for everything, but for most of the things out there, there is one. So for SVG support, for example, in Internet Explorer, it falls back to VML, which is vector markup language that they used to build, for example, the output of PowerPoints when you save them as HTML. So these polyfills are there to actually simulate the functionality of new browsers in old browsers. That, of course, comes with a problem. Should we really shoehorn new technology into legacy browsers? Should we really think that 3D animation or 2D animation that is hardware accelerated in newest browsers gets simulated with some Flash in Internet Explorer 6? Does it really make sense? Also, do patches add complexity? Because we need to test their performance. As soon as I say put a polyfill in there and I say, like, well, I'm supporting IE6, then it's also on to you to test how that thing performs. So if the 3D accelerated or the hardware accelerated CSS3 animation looks great on Safari and Chrome and on your iPhone and your iOS, and you test on Internet Explorer and it basically looks like it takes 5 minutes for animating from left to right, was it really worth it? Or should we not do it? I'm not sure. I mean, I want to use HTML5. I want to support everybody on the web. But I'm not sure if I really have to do JavaScript because I don't want to do testing for IE6 anymore. So my question that I was asking is, like, how about we move the IE less than 9 fixes to the server side? So instead of writing a div class equals section, I just, on my template, on the server side, I go through the system, and every time I find a section, I put the div with the class section around it. I can do that in an Apache module. I can do that on the server side everywhere I want to. And if you really, really look into the day-to-day work that we're doing, you don't write HTML by hand. You always write it with some middleware, Ruby, Python, Java, PHP, whatever. So we have the control on the server to spit out different HTML according to different browsers. So why don't we do that? Why do we do it all on the client side? Another big question that I haven't covered, but is interesting, is the client side fully the platform right now? I'm about to go to Stanford and give a course on web application development in autumn together with some guys from Google. And by definition, they said, like, we only go client side. We don't explain anything server side to people. Is this the right thing yet? Isn't it? I don't know. So making video and audio simpler was another thing that we talked about before, what HTML5 actually said. This is actually an automated checker in a digital camera that found out that if you take pictures of Southeast Asian people, it says, oh, that person probably blinked, so the photo isn't good. Very dangerous. But it was quite fun when people find this out. So embedding audio and video is easy in HTML5. As I said before, video source equals interview, OGB, Ahref, interview, OGB, download the video because it doesn't work for your browser. The browser does the rest for me. Keyboard accessible, works across different input devices, and so on and so forth. To make all capable browsers play the video, different formats, MP4, WebM, OGB, download the video in MP4 format. When there's a need for that, there's a market for that. There's a company out there called Vidly, the company is called encoding.com, but they created a service called Vidly, which just came out a week ago, and it's amazing. I'm using it right now for a lot of my stuff because it's just really, really cool. You upload a video there in any format that you want, and while you're uploading it, it already starts converting it for you. And it converts it to all the formats that you need to have in HTML5. It creates different versions for Chrome, for Firefox, for Internet Explorer, for Opera, for Safari. It creates versions for consoles, Nintendo DS, PlayStation Portable, Nintendo Wii. It creates versions for Android, Apple, for all the different Apple devices, for Blackberries, Nokias, Opera, Mini, Samsung, Sony Ericsson. So it's not free formats, like I said before, if you want to support every hardware out there that is HTML5 capable. It's about 27 different formats. And Vidly converts your video in about 15 minutes to all of them. Once you have them in there, you just put the Vidly URL in your source, and the system automatically detects what system you use and sends you the right video. Instead of having 10,000 different videos and you have to have source, and then the source order is sometimes a problem in iOS and so on and so forth. The short URL, the Vidly URL, does the redirection to the right video format for you. Again, we move to the server side to fix a problem that client side is just a pain for the end user to type in and do these kind of things. However, there's a real problem for businesses with HTML5, and I hadn't talked about that before. Good thing that we have people from Adobe that talk about it. And basically, apart from the heading, stealing content was never easier than with HTML5, there's a lot of truth in that. Because HTML5 format has no DRM, it has no encryption. What you put on the web is view-sourceable, downloadable, and you can get it. The idea is it's open content. It's a bit like saying, the heading is like saying, hey, I have this big LCD screen at home, and I kept my door open, had a blinking arrow saying, like, free LCD screen, and somebody stole it. The problem is that when it comes to video on the web, there's a big market out there that makes money with video, and they want to protect the video not to be downloadable. They want it to be just streamable. And there's nothing in HTML5 at the moment for that. There's no DRM, there's no encryption. All the video streams are actually available for you because that's what they do. But we have to think about a market as well. We have to think about the people that make money with video. And I'd rather have an NBC.com run on HTML5 than run on Flash still. Because, the other day I had somebody at my house and she had a daughter with her and the kid wanted to play Farmville on Facebook, and of the 7 computers I had at home, there was not a single one where she could do it until I installed Flash and some other plugins she needed. But I don't want to do that when I just want to watch some video. So we have to make sure that we do something in HTML5 that even the businesses that want to protect their content can use these technologies. And so far, there's no encryption in any of these formats. So can we expect content creators to create video in many formats to support an open technology? Can I go to a client and say, like, well, you have this video, it takes me now an hour to convert it to 27 different formats, but then you can have it on your website? Or can you say, hey, there's a Flash player, I can put it in there, it plays? What will the client go for? Can a service like Bitly be trusted for content creation and storage? I'm really excited about it right now, but what happens if the thing out of a sudden says, like, it's not free anymore? What happens if they get bought by somebody else and something happens to it? Nothing on the web is forever. The BBC just shut down a lot of their websites and these will be gone. Can I have a cool system like that? Can I trust it yet? Can I trust it with the content of my users? Is HTML not applicable for premium content? Have we forgotten that there's people out there that don't want their stuff to be open, but they should still be allowed to use the open technologies? So it's time for all of us to make initiative and make this work. It's not like standing there like, oh, there's no problem with that. There's like DRM, yeah, who cares? These people will die out. The open web will win over them. I hope so, but I don't think it's going to happen that quickly. I mean, we see it over and over again. It's like people build something close, somebody finds a hack for it, does something free and says, like, you could have done it like that in the first place, and then they get basically sued, and the thing is gone again. I want all of you to question authority and call out wrong messaging. I want you, when you see an HTML5 demo, I want you to call bullshit on people when it's not HTML5. I want you to complain when they say it's an HTML5 demo and you need to download a certain browser to see it, including us. Or even better, I want you to fix it and send it back to them and say, like, this is how it should have been done up front. And I want you to go and say, people, we're doing HTML5 training right now. You know, okay, how do I make this work in Internet Explorer 6? That's not HTML5, don't worry about it. So I want you to think about things that you see. I want you to get excited about new technology, but also question it. Because we haven't questioned things in a long, long time, and that's why we have all these systems that say, please upgrade to a better browser like Internet Explorer 5 to see this kind of website. The other day I had a website that wanted to redirect me to netscape.aol.com to download Netscape to see the content, because that's how old the thing was. Bad use of technology doesn't only break the end user experiences, it actually breaks the web. And if the open web, the HTML5 stuff, will not work out because of some stupid IP reasons or because of hardware acceleration on some closed hardware being better than in some other, I'm going to be pissed off because I want this to work. I want our job to be easier. I want our job to be predictable and write content for people that works, because then we can concentrate on building interfaces that work rather than sucking up the browsers and hope they do it right. Gawker just re-released. And now their URLs look like this. So without JavaScript, nothing happens. This is not a data endpoint. This is not a link. This is not what the web is about. This is not what search engines index. This is just hoping that everything works if the browser does it right for you. And there's a few things to fix this kind of stuff, but if people's decisions of redesigns already expect you to have a certain technology rather than building a website, then we're on thin ice. Then we're in the Arctic Explorer, where we basically build something cool, but forget about that there are people out there that actually don't have JavaScript, that have an old browser, that are on a really crappy mobile phone, and they should still get the content off your page. I find myself more and more looking at the print style or the mobile style of websites because they're much easier to read. Because I don't get the pop-up windows and interstitial ads and all these things out there. So I want that web to be beautiful, but I also want the web to be accessible. And right now, we're not doing that. The What Working Group is completely open. You don't have to be a Google employee, you don't have to be an Apple employee, you don't have to be a Microsoft guru, and you don't have to be a JavaScript guru to take part in there. You can sign up and be part of that. You can sign up and bitch and say, I'm sorry, but you're solving problems that nobody else has. I have a real problem here. What about this? What's happening to the outline algorithm? What happens when I put 30 H1s in my document and Google punishes me for doing the right thing? Why should I have to suffer that way when you're doing a specification? And specification is open, you can be part of that. On MDN, we have our developer network, and it's every month or so, we have a doc sprint. It's all wikis. Nothing of that stuff is closed. So if you have something cool to say, if you have some good documentation of a certain bug, if you have a documentation of a certain solution, be part of that and write it in there and make the documentation better. We need to have better documentation on the web, because otherwise people go to W3 schools and think that's the truth. And it's not. And that's all I had to say, so thank you very much.